Happy Holy Week, happy Holy Thursday. This is Father David Nix for Padre Peregrino Podcasts. Today's podcast is called, When Does the Church Have to Obey the State? The short answer is never, at least in arbitrary law. We will see that Romans 13 does imply criminal law. And today with us, we have a friend of mine. We've been friends for about 20 years, Mark Zarlingo. Mark, thanks for coming over to the Hermitage Stella Maris.
Thank you for having me. I was expecting a cave on the top of a mountain with fire lamps or something.
Exactly. But, if I were holier as my middle name Jerome is, I might be in a cave. But this is the top of a place. And Mark and I went to Regis Jesuit High School in Aurora, Colorado 20 years ago. And right before we started recording, we were just talking about how I was socially liberal. I actually at one point had my hair braided up. I was trying to dread it. And I had like an Amnesty International tie-dye, and I was writing letters against the death penalty. And I was always pro-life, but I was socially liberal, and Catholic-wise, I was liberal. Mark, on the other hand, was conservative politically, but had only been exposed to liberal Catholicism. I think you were in like the Young Republicans Club or something?
Right. So yeah, I was in the Young Republicans Club, very conservative, but I was pretty... At that point in time, I was still kind of pretty much into my faith. So the only faith I really ever knew or was exposed to was liberal, Jesuitical Catholicism.
And then in college, you followed a normal American college guy's path, right? Before you really had an awakening. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, sure. So, yeah, my story is pretty common. And I think whenever I tell this story, and I tell it quite a bit at the parish I've done some ministries at, people tend to relate to it. So once I left high school, I went off to college and immediately just stopped going to Mass. I was out partying like a rock star. I was, you know, every day was just, what can I do next to have a good time, to have fun? Everything I don't want to say I completely lost the idea of God, but for all intents and purposes, I became an atheist, especially right out of high school. And even some of the things I had read in high school, I was very influenced by Ayn Rand, a big-time atheist. And she obviously was very economically conservative, which I liked. But she was also an atheist, a hardcore atheist. And so that influenced me a lot, especially into college, to the point by the end of college, I would say, I was comfortable enough saying, I really don't believe in God at all. I just thought that it was something made up by people to explain things they didn't understand, make people feel better about death, which is right. Interesting considering everything that's going on right now. Mm. But it's just an excuse. And that's pretty much where I was at.
What finally caused your conversion?
So I'd say a couple years later, and there's a lot of movement of the chessboard in between there, but about maybe 4 years after I got out of college, I had this dream, and it was a very vivid dream. It came out of nowhere, really. And it was basically, I was standing outside of a large building. I didn't know what it was. And as I was standing there, a woman comes up to me. I didn't know what it was. I was looking around. I could see trees on this street. I saw kind of a strange man standing at the end of the street, but otherwise I was alone in front of this large building. And a woman comes up to me and takes me by the hand. She was dressed in all white. Hmm. Looked me in the eye. Like, it was clear as day. I've never had a dream that real in my life. And in fact, I've never had a dream that real since then. And she didn't say anything to me, but took me by the hand and looked at me in the eyes for a while, held it, and then walked me up these steps into this building, which was kind of a square building. And I walk in there, and it looked to be what appeared to be like a church. There was sort of an altar at the center, and there was what looked like pews. It was kind of modernist looking. So I was a little confused, but I could tell it was a church or something. And then she never said a word to me, and then the dream was over. Mm. But what was amazing about that was it was the realest dream I've ever had. And I woke up like almost in a sweat, you know, like what that was. Wow, that was wild. And at the time, I didn't know exactly was it, I didn't know what that was, because I thought it was like an angel or something. Mm. You know, because she was all dressed in white. And I thought about, oh man, that's almost like Virgin Mary, but Virgin Mary wears blue. So, you know, that's that can't be it. Right. And then, but after that, I, for whatever reason, you could tell like grace was starting to work a little bit in me. Because by that time I had already had kids, two kids at that point. And I started getting interested in where they were going to go to school. And I started thinking about, well, you know, I kind of want them to go to Catholic school. And then I started looking around, well, if I send them to Catholic school, maybe I should be going to church or something. And so then I go and check out, I was living in Illinois at the time. Maybe I should go check out the local church right there and see what's going on. And so I did. And so I would just go back into the, sit in the back of the mass a couple times and watch and then just leave. And that just started and just kept going. And so it was very slow and gradual.
What brought you back to confession then?
It was very slow and gradual. When we moved back to, I'm in Colorado now. Yeah. We moved back here. I knew at that point, it was so gradual. But I knew at that point, I'm like, you know what? I never got confirmed because I had never been confirmed. It just wasn't, I had my first communion. I was baptized, but I just never got confirmed. No one ever made me do it. And I wasn't interested in doing it in high school. Mm. So I was like, I really should get confirmed. So then I, you know, went to the local parish, which was a half mile down the street, and said, you know, I want to get confirmed. And then they enrolled me in the RCIA program. And then my wife, who was not Catholic, grew up a Methodist, said, well, if you're going to be going every Sunday, I might as well go too. And so then she started coming with me. And then she's like, well, this is okay. I believe in this stuff they're teaching us. And then so she ended up coming into the church at the same time I got my confirmation. And at that point, a year later, my two kids, by that point, they were over the age of 7. I said, well, they had never been baptized.
Oh, wow.
Because I didn't care. I mean, I didn't know. I mean, it wasn't that big of a deal, right? Because I didn't know any better. But now at least I knew, like, oh, they should be baptized. So then they went through they went through RCIA the following year, and they got all their initial sacraments together the following year. And that was at a pretty liberal church.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, that's how it kind of started and from there. But at that point I would consider myself a liberal.
Yeah.
Catholic, because I still didn't know any better at that point. So that was about 12 years ago.
That's right. And then Mark got a hold of me. I've been a priest 10 years in May. Mark got a hold of me, I think about 8 years into my priesthood a couple years ago. And we were both just basically waking up to tradition. Now, Mark is a civil attorney, and he knows a lot about constitutional law. And that's where today's topic is going to be really exciting, because we're going to see where the law of the church intersects constitutional law, civil law. And now, for our listeners, just to kind of be briefed on this, I think this will be exciting for you, because Mark and I, at least the past couple weeks, have disagreed on one thing in the whole COVID-19 thing. Is more or less, I've agreed with the bishop shutting down the masses, the Holy Mass, because of the social distancing. I actually think this could go big. I don't want to put words in Mark's mouth. He doesn't really think it is going to go big. He thinks it's overblown by the media. But what you're going to hear on this podcast is whether COVID-19 is just going to tank our country economically and it's really not a medical danger, or we're going to have millions of Americans die. Mark and I's beliefs dovetail insofar as we believe that the church needs to be making her own decisions. When there's abortion centers open and liquor stores open and Walmart's open, and we immediately, some dioceses, thanks be to God that this is not Colorado, but some dioceses have even stopped emergency sacraments, baptism and confession and things like that, which I don't even think the state has actually mandated. It's just very mysterious that some dioceses have just shut it down. Where Mark and I are going to agree on this is that the state really has no power over the church's worship, and the sacraments are part of worship. And so we're going to, this isn't going to be just a tough guy. Well, we think this because it's the opposite of what the liberal bishops do. No, we're going to look at constitutional law. We're going to look at the magisterium of the Catholic Church. And we're going to go back even to 5th century popes. I'm going to read to you what a 5th century pope actually said to the emperor about a similar time that we're in. So we're going to look at this academically to see. And there's a lot of intersecting things in this mystery of COVID-19. You have church law, you have state law, you have medicine, you have people's conspiracy theories, you have really high levels of emotions and all this. And I said to Mark before we started recording, he's a civil attorney who's very well read. I'm a Catholic priest who's had way too much time on my hands to become well read the last couple of years. But the weird thing about this C19 is we don't have all the answers. But we are going to give you guys the tools to look at some parts of constitutional law and some parts of the magisterium to really see why the church doesn't have to obey the state except for some of the caveats we're going to look at in Romans 13, which is essentially criminal law. Mark writes a blog called Catholic Esquire. Probably most of you know Esquire is a term that means attorney. And as I said, Mark's a civil attorney. At Catholic Esquire, Mark Zarlingo's last blog post was called "Mr. Smith Stays at Home, Free Exercise Doesn't Mean What You Think." And we're going to take a look at that, at what he asserts in there. Mark, would you tell us just briefly your launching point story? It had to do with peyote and in Oregon, if I remember, 5-10 years ago?
Yeah, so the reason I brought this up was because there was a case, a Supreme Court case back in 1990 that was very important for people of faith, not just Catholics, but people of all faiths should know about it, because it was a major landmark case, in my opinion, as far as how far the government is allowed to go is in restricting religious practice under the First Amendment, free exercise clause of the First Amendment, which says, you know, the government shall not infringe on the free exercise of religion. It's right there next to the free speech clause. So a lot of people think, of all religions, think that the government just cannot interfere or infringe on your right to practice your religion. And what this case told us was that, in fact, they absolutely can. And what the case told us also was what the parameters were in order to do that. And it kind of helped define how courts, the civil courts, understand and interpret the free exercise clause in the First Amendment.
Tell us about that case.
So the case actually involved, it was in Oregon. It was involving two men who belonged to a Native American church. And a part of the Native American church was that you, as a ritual, you would ingest a peyote, which is like a hallucinogenic drug.
Yep.
And it was outlawed in the state of Oregon. But it was, they claimed it was part of their religious practice, and no one disputed that they were legitimately part of this church and that this was a legitimate ritual. No one disputed that part. So they ended up getting fired from their normal jobs because they violated the law in ingesting the peyote. They filed an unemployment claim. It was denied because they broke the law, and that was the reason they got fired. So they said, well, you can't deny us public benefits because we exercised our right to religion. We were just doing our religious practice, so therefore we were protected, and the state can't deny us unemployment benefits. And that was the nature of the case, what happened. And so then it ultimately got up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, in an opinion written by Justice Scalia, said, nope, we're sorry, the state can deny you your unemployment benefits because the state has a right to regulate criminal activity, and as long as it's applied, essentially, it's a law that applies to everyone, and they're not singling you out because your religion. You have to follow it. And the fact that it interferes with your religion and your practice, it doesn't matter. It's too bad. You lose, and the state is able to do this.
Now, some people might think criminal activity has nothing to do with what we're facing with this whole COVID-19 thing, but if I remember correctly, Cuomo in New York has actually threatened to close down any churches that stay open. I believe there was a Protestant pastor in Tampa who was actually arrested for having a worship service. So we're not just talking about the certain tastes of Democrats or certain liberals. We're now being threatened as Catholics with this COVID-19 thing, with criminal activity. Now, again, there's half the listeners out there really do think C-19 is going to go big. Half the other listeners think it's overblown by the media. But what nobody can deny is that places like Cuomo have threatened to shut down churches even after this whole pandemic passes. So what Mark's bringing up here with the peyote case is, does the state have the ability to claim that you're doing criminal activity by your type of religion? And how does that tie into where we are right now, Mark?
Well, and make no mistake about it, the stay-at-home orders now, they have criminal penalties attached to them. Absolutely no question.
Really?
Now, they're different in every state. I know before ours went statewide in our local health board, the penalty was up to $5,000 and 18 months in jail.
Wow.
For a violation. Amazing. So that's criminal.
That's criminal, right.
And part of that, they did not allow for attendance at religious gatherings.
And so we're going to go a lot deeper than this. I think most of the listeners obviously know there's quite a bit of contradiction on what is called essential right now. And there's too many people talking about this, so we don't want to spend a lot of time on this. But I do find it very weird that, again, Walmart is open, and obviously there's nothing wrong with Walmart. Well, there are things wrong with Walmart, slave labor and stuff, but I was there today, so I guess I'm a hypocrite on that. But abortion centers that are open are considered essential, but churches are not being – is not essential. Now, as I said earlier, Mark and I disagree if the bishop should have shut down masses all over this country and the world and things like that. But I want our listeners to actually listen for in this podcast as we look at some of the ancient statements of the magisterium is that has to be bishops being informed by physicians coming to these conclusions. Now, maybe in this country that's what happened. But what Mark and I want to make the point is that on matters of worship, the state can never make an active influence on this. But now this is a little bit difficult because we all know that Justice Scalia, was a pretty conservative, in fact, probably you could consider him a traditional Catholic. He went to the Latin Mass. Actually, the parish I stay at for my pro-life stuff out in D.C. was his home parish. His son was actually the pastor there for a while. And I was sort of surprised, Mark, that you were surprised in your blog post that Scalia, of all people, didn't give the green light to peyote. I kind of think, well, no, a hallucinogenic drug should not be considered to be a religious practice. Your blog post almost made it sound like you agree with the two Native Americans on this.
Well, it's a little nuanced because I'm willing to give Justice Scalia an out on this, because if you're looking at the way the Constitution, our federal constitution, the Bill of Rights, was drafted and the reason for it, then his decision makes sense. And the reason is because if you don't want the government or the courts diving into whose religion is valid and whose isn't, do you want the courts to decide whether peyote is actually an important part of your religion or not? Do you want the courts saying, you know what, I don't think children under the age of 21 should be drinking sacramental wine as part of a holy mass because, you know what,
gotcha.
I read something that says you don't really even have to have it. You can just have the Eucharist, and that's the same. So we're not going to make an exception for people under the age of 21 for drinking sacramental wine.
Yeah, what they would call sacramental.
What they would call sacramental wine.
Blood of Christ, but because the courts would call it sacramental wine.
Right. Yeah. To the courts, that would be sacramental wine.
Right. Right.
And
okay,
so
I see your point.
And so then, so that's what Scalia is basically saying, and in that way, it is a conservative position because he's saying we don't want the government involved in this.
Okay.
We don't want to get in the business of figuring out who's being truthful and saying in good faith this is part of the religion, or we don't want to get into dogma. This isn't what we do.
Yeah.
What his goal was saying, look, if there's a valid law, otherwise valid law, and it's applicable to everyone, so long as you're not singling out religion, then you just have to follow it.
So what would you say about this? Let's say, well, what did Cuomo say? Give me the 30-second version of what Cuomo said. You know, well, in New York, just didn't he threaten? I saw this on a thumbnail, and I really should have read it. He threatened to close down churches permanently after the C-19 pandemic. Should they violate anything now?
Am I correct about that? The mayor, New York City, De Blasio.
Oh, De Blasio said it. Okay.
Yes, he from my understanding, and I haven't read the article for a while, but he basically was saying, as far as religion, religious practices, and religious gatherings go, you know, please don't do that. Otherwise, we have no problem in coming in and shutting those down.
Now, let me give you some pushback. Romans 13 says Paul is writing to the early Catholic community saying we have to follow the law. So how would you answer that? If here you and I are sitting in my little hermitage, about to quote some ancient popes, but even more ancient than that is Romans 13 saying we Catholics have to obey the law. So if the law is a priest can't even go into someone who's dying to hear their confession, because if there's 5 or 10 people in there and you're violating the numbers of the social distancing that's permitted by the state, and this could grow a pandemic and kill a bunch more people, then why should I? We'll table the mass topic for a minute, but let's just talk on the ones we agree on: baptism, confession. If someone is in a room with 10 people and this person's dying and I'm about to violate a social distancing thing, shouldn't I listen to the state if Paul tells me to in Romans 13?
Yes, if the state is legislating on a matter that's within their competence, because that's where the render unto Caesar what is Caesar and render unto God what is God's. And see, Christ makes a very significant distinction there between there is a realm of authority that belongs to God alone. And yes, there is a realm of authority that belongs to the state.
That's
absolutely
right.
Yep. He even recognized Pilate's authority, I think, didn't he?
He did, yeah. He said, you would have no authority unless it came from above.
Yeah, but he essentially recognized even Pilate's authority to be a civil, secular ruler.
That's true.
So what Paul is saying is absolutely right. And I get in trouble with my libertarian friends all the time because they say, well, we should just disobey if they violate my rights, the government. I'm like, if there's a valid secular civil authority, you need to follow them as best you can. Yeah. Unless they're asking you to do something against the divine law, the natural law.
That's right.
Then you have a duty to disobey, because at the end of the day, all law comes from God. Christ is king, and you owe the highest duty to him and not your secular ruler.
That's right. And now every religion out there is going to claim there is a special, but I think most of my listeners are probably, if not traditional, at least conservative enough to get that we're not ashamed of the next line we're going to say. That Catholicism really is the one true religion. And we've become way too afraid the past 50 years of saying that. And I really believe this has been influenced by all the ecumenical talk, maybe even the religious liberty documents of Vatican II. But if you look at every pope from 500 to at least 1950, there's the understanding that there's only one true religion, that's Catholicism, and that there is every state, because it's an entity, owes worship to Christ the King. This is the previous blog post or podcast I did called The Social Rights of Christ the King. Mark wrote in his blog post, quote, "The problem from a traditional and authentic Catholic point of view with all of this is that the underlying premises accepted by the court are fundamentally flawed and necessarily result in the rejection of both the divine and natural law as expressed in Christ's social kingship." This a little bit later. This is important to remember when we consider Christ's social kingship. All authority, including both civil and ecclesial, ultimately comes from God. Christ reminds his followers that all power in heaven and earth has been given to me, Matthew 28. Christ is the King of kings and the Lord of lords, Apocalypse 19:16. And then one paragraph later, Mark quotes Quas Primus. It would be a grave error, on the other hand, to say Christ has no authority whatever in civil affairs, since by virtue of the absolute empire over all creatures committed to him by the Father, all things are in his power. Now, what Mark and I are agreeing on here is that Catholicism actually is unique in that we actually have divine revelation. So what we can evaluate, as Mark said, competence of these civil laws, we can evaluate the competence of civil law when we line it up to divine law and natural law. C.S. Lewis was not a Catholic, but he had a great line. He says, religion is man's search for God. Christianity is God's search for man. So more pointed than that, we could say all religions is man's search for God. Catholicism is God's search for man. And so it stands apart. It actually is different. And therefore, all of the parts of divine revelation that refer to divine law and natural law, if a civil law does not match up with that, or if it's arbitrary or if it's considered unjust, we don't have to obey it. And that's where, again, the title of this podcast, when does the church have to obey the state? It's essentially only, if you look in Romans 13, when the state has the sword. That's actually talking about the death penalty. So it's actually divine revelation that the death penalty is permitted by the state, and the Catholic Church supports that. That's divine revelation. It's in the Bible. Nobody can change that. The death penalty is part of divine revelation. But we're not talking about that today. We're going to talk about COVID-19 and can the state say you can't do the sacraments? One more quote from Mark's blog, and then I'll let him talk. Mark says, quote, "But even if the stay-at-home orders are laws of general applicability, which I argue they are not because of the numerous exceptions contained in them, including for abortion clinics and liquor stores, as faithful Catholics, we are bound to give due honor and worship to God as a matter of justice. That is, we owe God proper worship in the matter he provided to us through centuries of tradition handed down. We also must take care that our souls and those of our family members receive the graces they need for eternal salvation. These are matters of divine and natural law. The secular government does not get to decide who and when we receive graces or worship the Lord, regardless of whether they think mass attendance will pose a public danger. This is a matter reserved to Christ and his church, to Christ and his church authorities to decide after careful consideration and prudential judgments," close quote. Okay, anything to add to yourself there, Mark?
No, I mean, my point was that when you issue orders like the ones we have, these stay-at-home orders, number one, I would argue that under that Smith case we talked about earlier, I would still say there's a free exercise problem there. Because what's happening is they have so many exceptions that it's not generally applicable. What's happening here with these stay-at-home orders, which I think are completely unprecedented on this massive scale. And, you know, the stay-at-home orders are done by 50 states, but they're pretty much all been coordinated at the same time.
Okay.
And they essentially say the same thing. We've never seen anything like that on that scale in the history of this country, ever. And what the government is essentially doing is they're picking and choosing what they think are essential. And they're saying, this is essential, this is not essential. Abortion mills are essential. Hobby Lobby is not essential. Liquor stores, pot shops, essential. Religious gatherings, not essential. They're picking and choosing what's essential. And that, to me, is not a law of general applicability.
Right.
I mean, either everyone's going to be in danger and you have to protect everybody and the law applies to everybody, or it doesn't. Otherwise, now you are infringing on the free exercise of religion. What my point and my argument is that whether we attend Mass, those are matters that belong to the church. And those should be matters that are left up to the local bishop or whoever the proper church authority is. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that I have some concerns about bishops complying with these orders for the sake of complying with the order, rather than making their own prudential judgment about whether it's safe or not to have parishioners come to Mass. Because we're talking about grace, we're talking about sacraments, we are talking about eternal salvation, and those are matters reserved for the church and not the state.
That's right. And there's a lot of reasons why we Catholics are against the separation of church and state. And yes, you guys heard me correctly, about 200 popes would agree with me on this. We as Catholics are against the separation of church and state. But one very practical reason why the Catholic Church is against the separation of church and state is because she realizes that one of the two will influence the other. To put it in very colloquial terms, one of the two is going to bully the other. Now, I know from all of our seventh grade, you know, history books and stuff, people made it look like it was the church that usually did the bullying, the Inquisition and stuff like that. But if you really read church history, you're going to see that it was actually the church that always stood in danger of being bullied. Actually, even Thomas Jefferson, when he wrote the Separation of Church and State, which is just a letter, was actually to protect the Baptist church from the state. It was even in the United States constitutional law that was set up so as to protect the church from the state. But the Catholic Church's history, or rarely magisterium, goes quite a bit deeper because it recognizes that a detente between the church and the state is always going to be a false detente. Now, there's more reasons than this, but one reason traditional Catholic theology is against the separation of church and state is because we realize if we don't have a little influence over the state, they're going to have a big influence over us. Now, many people think this is just kind of medieval theology, but I want to read to you guys from Pope Gelasius. This is in 494 AD. This is a 5th century pope, very, very early, saying the same thing. So listen to Pope Gelasius. He's writing to his secular emperor, Emperor Anastasius. Quote, "There are two powers, august emperor, by which this world is chiefly ruled, namely the sacred authority of the priests and the royal power. Of these, that of the priests is more right. Of these, that of the priests is the more weighty, since they have to render an account for even the kings of men in the divine judgment. You are also aware, dear son, that while you are permitted honorably to rule over humankind, yet in things divine you bow your head humbly before the leaders of the clergy and await from their hands the means of your salvation. In the reception and proper disposition of the heavenly mysteries, you recognize that you should be subordinate rather than superior to the religious order, and then in these matters, you depend on their judgment rather than wish to force them to follow your will." Close quote. Okay, so I mentioned earlier what's happening in New York City, Tampa. Can you imagine if a bishop or a cardinal on the East Coast were to write to the mayor, call him my son, dear son, if he were to say, "There are two powers, dear emperor, by which this world is chiefly ruled, namely the sacred authority of the priests and the royal power. Of these, that of the priests is the more weighty, since they have to render an account for even the kings of men in the divine judgment. You are also aware, dear son, that while you are permitted honorably to rule over humankind, yet in things divine you bow your head humbly before the leaders of the clergy and await from their hands the means of your salvation." Close quote. So what I'm trying to say is if we applied this to COVID-19, if we were to apply traditional Catholic theology of the non-separation of church and state, it's because the church is permitted to influence the state, not vice versa. Why? Because the Catholic Church's effects, not only in heavenly matters, but even in earthly matters, because these are joined, we're not Gnostics, there's an incarnational reality where the earthly matters do bear weight upon heavenly matters of our salvation. Now, it doesn't mean the church can say how long a suspension bridge should be or something like that. But anytime there's a matter of salvation and there is a contradiction, the Catholic Church wins. That's not me being a tough guy to just flex my muscles against bishops or something. That is the magisterium of the Catholic Church, that when there is a rub in civil law or earthly law between divine law and civil law, divine law wins.
Father, I just wanted to add another quote for you. It was on a post I had written last year. It's a quote from St. Augustine who addresses this same issue. And, it helps to have St. Augustine also to back up a point here. And he says, and it's sort of an obscure quote, but he says, quote, "If therefore anyone thinks that because he is Christian, he is not obligated to pay taxes or imposts or does not have to render the honor due to those powers which deal with these matters, he is seriously mistaken. Likewise, if anyone thinks that he must be subject in such a manner that the man who excels with a certain majesty in the administration of temporal affairs is thought to have power even over his faith, he falls into an even greater error."
So what I want our listeners to catch is, Mark and I are going to obey the bishops if they decide to cancel masses and things like that. But what they have to do is that decision on their own without any influence from the state. Now, bishops can listen to lawyers and physicians and make their decisions and stuff, but the state has no right, as we see in New York, to threaten closing down. Most of my listeners are used to my conspiracy theories. Where do you think this is going? I mean, when you were talking, Mark, about how we've never seen people locked in, not locked, but, this extreme social distancing, all the states doing it at once, this strange rub between what's considered essential and non-essential. I didn't prep you for this, so you don't have to answer this, but where do you think this is going on all of this?
Sure, and I don't think this is just an attack on religion. I mean, this is an attack on freedoms that Americans have enjoyed since the beginning of this country, and at least have thought they have enjoyed. I have been shocked and disturbed by how quickly Americans in general have fallen into this trap of just accepting everything they hear on TV, everything that comes out of their governor's mouths, and they just give up everything without a fight whatsoever, regardless of the orders. I'm trying to think of the right word here, but it's an amazing affront to liberty on all levels, not just religion.
Yeah.
On so many ways. I mean, to order someone to stay at home unless they need to go to a predetermined business that the government predetermines is needed is shocking. To order citizens to not be able to travel for any reason unless the government pre-approves the reason upon pain of jail time and fines is shocking. These orders coming from the governors, the executive authorities, these aren't voted on by the people.
Yeah.
What you have here is pure, utter dictatorship. I mean, this is what dictatorship is. It's the rule of one guy. Now we have 50 states. The rule of one guy deciding who gets to, which businesses get to stay open, which ones have to close, the citizens, where they can go, where they can shop, how they can shop, when they can do it. And it's just an order handed down in the name of trying to make things more safe.
Now, would you say that dictator's Trump?
No. I would say it's a combination of executives, mostly the governors now in all 50 states and local authorities, that really also shockingly managed to coordinate all of this almost at the exact same time.
Maybe we could say almost more of a tyrannical oligarchy then?
I suppose so. Because of the nature of our system, right? It had to be that way. Every state has their own quarantine laws, which give the governors authority to do that. That's in theory how the governors are able to issue these orders, is they have books on the law that give the governors authority to issue quarantine orders. The problem is they're not even quarantining the people that are sick. They're quarantining everybody.
Well, that's
so
it. That's
all the
actually,
healthy
right.
people are being ordered to locked in and essentially jailed in their own homes.
Yeah, that's the wrong definition of a – you didn't use the wrong definition of a quarantine. A physician – actually, it was Matt who was on it last week. He texted me. He's like, we're using the wrong term, quarantine. Quarantine is when someone has a diagnosis or they're waiting for the diagnosis. So there's really no description of this stay-at-home time. So you're right. That's not really quarantine. Now, Mark and I disagree on the epidemiology scale of how big this could get. And I'm actually all for social distancing, but I hope the bishops made this decision without any influence of the state. Because while we can take medical advice from physicians from the state, even in a pandemic, the state can't command us what to do. Why? Because our laws come from God and theirs do not. And I know that sounds very medieval to most listeners, but that's our magisterium. Now, Mark pointed out in his article that all religions might have to answer to the Constitution, but not Catholicism, because it's God's one true religion. Well, we do as far as criminal law, but we are above it in matters where divine law and natural law comes to us from divine revelation. So again, think about that Pope Gelasius quote that I just read you, or think of Pope Pius IX trying to defend his papal states, or think of Pope Pius XII hiding Jews. You know, Pope Pius XII was not Hitler's pope, like liberals call him, but rather his disobeying the state saved over 850,000 Jews. Jews in his time, including Einstein, admitted this. So this brings up the big question in the title of the podcast: when does the church have to obey the state? Basically never, except for possibly criminal matters, and even then the church has frequently fought to try in court her own priests. Mark can correct me on this, but my understanding is Romans 13 is clear that we must obey the state on criminal matters, but this new idea of stopping mass when abortion clinics and Walmart is still open is arbitrary law, and it doesn't have to be obeyed. Again, I'll respect a bishop who closes public masses in a pandemic, but my issue is this. He should do it based on his decision, not the state forcing his hand. And that's what I hope happened all across the country. But if you look at New York's threats against churches that disobey them, it's pretty clear we've all folded before the state. And last thing before I hand off the mic to Mark on this, I wish I had opened this because I've been thinking about it all week, but I saw on Facebook a little thumbnail for some Orthodox church. I think it was probably in the Eastern Bloc or former Eastern Bloc. And an Orthodox church refused to actually capitulate. Why? Assumedly because they understood the communists did this at one point to them, that the state tried to rule over the communist, the Russian priests under Gorbachev and who was before him? It was everyone before Gorbachev, basically.
Khrushchev.
He was a real bad one, yeah. And so basically, a very small percentage of Russian bishops and Russian Orthodox priests stayed strong. And a lot of them were put in jail and tortured and everything. Most of the bishops and priests just completely capitulated to the state. Well, these Orthodox churches, at least in the some of these Eastern Bloc countries, they realize they're not going to let the state close them down. Now, unfortunately, OCA, or Orthodox Church of America, they've totally capitulated here. Someone sent me something yesterday. They're now allowing phone conversations. Or sorry, they're allowing phone confessions. That's absolutely insane. That the Orthodox Church of America is now allowing phone confessions. I mean, it totally dismantles the incarnational fact of the sacraments that was given by Christ to the apostles. So that really shows that this apostasy that we're seeing of people falling away from the faith is more than just Catholics. We're seeing it even among Orthodox, and if you can use the term apostasy applied to Protestants, in that direction too. But I guess what I'm trying to say as I bring up communists is we should have learned this lesson by reading our history books from 50 years ago, that the state should have no influence on closing down a church, because when they do, they're not going to reopen it.
Right. And I just want to clarify too, and we are not advocating theocracy.
Right.
Okay. That's often a straw man argument that's yep. leveled back against this position of the church. You want theocracy. Theocracy is when you have the clerics and the church officials actually running secular functions, just like in Iran. Kind of, that's they're both secular and church leaders at the same time. That's theocracy. That is not the position of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church, as you said, Father, recognizes the sphere of civil authority. We don't want the priests, no offense, we don't want you figuring out how long the traffic light laws. We shouldn't have the bishops deciding what our tax rate is in order to fund fixing of the roads. Those are things that are secular and civil and have nothing to do with salvation and faith. And for the most part, between the Catholics and the government of the United States, especially in the last 100 years or so, mostly because the Catholic Church in a lot of ways has given up this authority and power and kind of laid down on this one. Remember John Kennedy, the first Catholic, who said he'd never let the Pope tell him what to do as president?
He'd never let his Catholicism influence him or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, something to that effect, mm-hmm. right?
Archbishop Chappie always pointed out, and he kept his promise.
he sure did.
Yeah.
And so what's happened is that, for the most part, there's been somewhat of a harmony because the government says as long as those Catholics stay in their churches, stay in their buildings, they can do their mass, whatever they want. We'll grant them the exception for their sacramental wine, because that's the reason why we're able to do that and not break the law, is because the civil government accepted that. Mm-hmm. We'll let them do whatever they want in their churches, buildings. These stay-at-home orders is one of the first times, I'm not saying the very first time, but this level, this blanket laws across so many states and affecting so many people, where we've ever actually had, I would say, a real direct order from the state government telling the Catholic Church, you cannot gather for mass, you cannot gather, you can Some of them, you can't even open your doors, depending on what state.
Wow.
Now, in some states, they say it's okay. You know, you can still open your doors, and we deem you essential. But you still have to be limited to no more than 10 people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there's... But the point of it is it's the state government telling the church what they can and cannot do.
And the weird thing is, thankfully, this isn't the case for our bishops in Colorado, but some bishops have strangely even gone beyond the governors and done a lockdown against even emergency sacraments. I mean, I won't say where this was, but I had a family reach out to me with several children in one of those dioceses where the bishop slash cardinal had closed down even emergency sacraments. I couldn't find a priest to disobey that law. And again, that's one of those matters where it's not disobedience. If you look at some previous blog posts I've done on particular law, we're obedient to bishops. On ecclesial law, we're obedient to the magisterium. On divine law, we are obedient to divine revelation. So just as a superior cannot, under obedience, command an inferior to commit a sin of commission, so also he cannot command a sin of omission. And that's where I had no problem with what I did next with this family. Because I couldn't find a priest in this place on the phone, again, this is outside of Colorado, I couldn't find a priest. I walked this dad through baptizing his own child. And he did it. Because for one, I think we might be on lockdown for a year. But secondly, even the new code of canon law that came out under Pope John Paul II in 1983 says babies must be baptized quam primum, as soon as possible. And so I'm not going to feel guilty about that at all, because the salvation of souls, that's actually the last canon in the Code of Canon Law, the salvation of souls is the supreme law of the church. So I had canon law on my side in walking this dad through baptism. Now, people might say, well, if you couldn't find a priest to do this, then maybe you're disobedient like the early Protestants. No. Maybe, and I'm going to actually propose this instead. Do you realize that 99% of all of the Catholic bishops in the 16th century led 99% of all of their priests and laity outside the Catholic Church through dropping the faith for Anglicanism? And this is where we have to be able to delineate between particular law, ecclesial law, divine law, natural law, and below all of these is civil law. So, and at the very top of this is the glory of God and the salvation of souls. So we have the magisterium. This isn't me being Zorro on my own or whatever like this. We have the magisterium. I even have the new code of canon law on my side on this. So I can't even understand these cardinals and bishops who've gone one step beyond in saying you can't even do emergency sacraments.
I can't either, and all I can say is that I think that, and it's the nature of society that and the culture we're living in now, where we live in America, I think we have to admit this as Catholics, we live in a secular humanist society with an essentially atheistic government.
Yep.
And because of that, that is the world we're living in, and I think that many of the bishops are somewhat feeling overwhelmed by that,
mm-hmm.
and feel that there really is no option for them in this current society we live in. Years ago, back in the Middle Ages, these things never would have been an issue. In America today, it is. Yeah.
You did. Like, if you look at the 10th century, there was feudalism influencing, like, buying your own bishop. So there was... They had this happen, but what was interesting is the church pushed against it. So we had these crises where feudal lords were buying bishoprics for who they wanted, but the church reform came on down on the side of tradition.
I'm not saying there wasn't disagreements between, let's say, some king and a pope ever.
Okay.
I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that in theory, at the end of the day, the church and the state would work together in harmony and come to some sort of resolution.
Okay.
There was never this power, you know, this power struggle, this idea of church, it's either church or state, and one has to win and destroy the other. I think that came out, a lot of that came out of the Protestant Revolution.
Okay.
And the Enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is once you had all these different sects fighting each other,
right?
That's how you come up with the First Amendment we have now. James Madison thought it was a great idea. He said, oh, it's great, all these different sects, because they fight it and keep each other in check, and then no one, there's never any religious wars anymore.
Right.
And then so they come up with the First Amendment that says there is no establishment of religion. Any religion is good. Any religion will go. And we won't interfere with your little sect and your little practice. And that was the mindset of our framers. But we come from a Protestant background and a Protestant legal theory. And that's the struggle the Catholic Church has always had in America.
And that brings up a really interesting topic of religious freedom in Vatican II. Because if you look at all the documents through the Middle Ages, the reason the Church didn't believe in religious freedom per se, as we say it now, it's not because Jews and Muslims were ever forced to convert. Even if you look at the roughest times of the Inquisition, it was only the fake converts that were tried, and then they were only killed after they had two infringements of a fake conversion. And even then it came to like somewhere between 2,000 and 5,000 people killed by the Inquisition in 500 years. Which is about one day of communism in the 1970s or one day of communism in the 1980s. So we won't get into like comparing numbers. But my point is this, that through the Middle Ages, the Church not believing in religious freedom, it wasn't that those of other religions didn't have rights. It's that false religions didn't have rights. Why? Because error has no rights. And I really think if we had maintained that, that would have given us a backbone against all of the tyrannical totalitarianism that we see foisted upon the Church right now, because then we would have actually had the conclusion and the backbone to say, but Catholicism's different because it's the only world religion with no errors in it. I really do believe there's a connection between traditional theology of saying there is no religious freedom because there's only one thing that makes us free, and that's Christ and his Church. Other people can follow erroneous religions, and we're not going to stop them. But in a true Catholic society, those false religions have no, even before God's eyes in a place as secular as the United States, false religions actually have no rights before God because error has no rights. If we had maintained what I know seems like arrogance before the rest of the world, but is actually humility before divine revelation, I think that humility would have given us the strength to stand up against bullies.
The only thing I can say about that, Father, is that brings us right up head to head with Vatican II and the Dignitatis Humanae document. And that is worth a podcast in
itself.
Right.
You're right. That's worth a whole other podcast. I want to give everyone just a little preview of next week. You might be surprised that after Mark and I pushed it in this direction, what we're going to talk about next week is divine providence, that under divine providence is God's positive will and permissive will. And so if God is enduring lukewarm bishops and or malicious members of the state, we're going to actually entertain the possibility that what St. Thomas Aquinas calls secondary causes, that this chastisement, I know there's been debate if this is a chastisement, what I'm going to propose next week on this podcast with Mark, and he may or may not disagree with me, we haven't talked too much about this, what I'm going to propose in next week's podcast is, yes, this is a chastisement, but a lack of a chastisement would be more of a sign of God's justice, where chastisement is God's mercy. What I'm going to propose next week is that we need to take our medicine. Whether this is a problem of the governors or a problem of the bishops, whether this is a medical problem or it's just a blown out, it's an overblown thing that really isn't going to affect many people medically, and it's just going to put our country into an economic depression with rioting and stuff because of the whole fear factor involved, whatever all that. If we look at this with the eyes of the saints, if we look at this with the eyes of the Bible, we have to say, you know what? This country coming to a halt is because we are running over the edge to hell. God can't let everyone keep using their oral contraceptive pill and pornography and everything. Something had to pull us to a halt. And what I'm going to propose on next week's podcast is this chastisement isn't a sign of God's anger. It's actually a sign of his love if everything tanks. If we all end up in Hoovervilles in a year or two, I know this is going to sound weird, easy for me to say as a single hermit. I know it's going to be harder on you families. We have to take our medicine because we deserve it at this point. We just deserve it.